Numbers chapter 6. And the Lord, verse 1, spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say to them, When either man or woman shall separate themselves to vow a vow of a Nazarite, to separate themselves unto the Lord, he, verse 3, shall separate himself from wine and strong drink, and shall drink no vinegar of wine or vinegar of strong drink, neither shall he drink any liquor of grapes, nor eat moist grapes or dried raisins. For all the days of his separation shall he eat nothing that is made of the vine tree, from the kernels even to the husk. All the days of the vow of his separation there shall no razor come upon his head, until the days be fulfilled in which he separateth himself unto the Lord. He shall be holy, and shall let the locks of the hair of his head grow. Verse 6, And all the days that he separateth himself unto the Lord, he shall come at no dead body. He shall not make himself unclean for his father or his mother, for his brother or for his sister, when they die. Because the consecration of his God is upon his head, all the days of his separation he is holy unto the Lord. Now, verse 9, if any man die very suddenly by him, this man who's separated, and he hath defiled the head of his consecration, then he shall shave his head in the day of his cleansing, and on the seventh day shall he shave it. On the eighth day, verse 10, he shall bring two turtle doves or two young pigeons to the priest, to the door of the tabernacle, and the priest shall offer the one for a sin offering, and the other for a burnt offering, and make an atonement for him, for that he sinned by the dead, and shall hallow his head the same day. And he shall consecrate unto the Lord the days of his separation, and bring a lamb of the first year for a trespass offering, but the days that were before shall be lost, because his separation was defiled. Verse 13, this is the law of the Nazarite. When the days of his separation are fulfilled, then he shall be brought to the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and he shall offer his offering to the Lord, one he-lamb of the first year without blemish for a burnt offering, and one ewe-lamb of the first year for a sin offering, and one ram for peace offerings. Verse 15, a basket of unleavened bread, mingled with oil for meat offerings and drink offerings. And then verse 18 says, The Nazarite shall shave the head of his separation, the locks that were growing, at the door of the tabernacle, and they shall take the hair of the head of the separation and put it in the fire which is under the sacrifice of the peace offerings. So this verse 21 is the law of the Nazarite who hath vowed, and of his offering unto the Lord for his separation, beside that his hand shall get. According to the vow which he vowed, so he must do after the law of his separation. The book of Numbers deals with the organization of God's people in preparation for God's program. The book of Numbers deals with the organization of God's people in preparation for God's program. That is, God had a plan or a program, and that was to bring his people into the promised land, a land that flows with milk and honey. You see, the people of Israel had already been redeemed back in the book of Exodus. The theme of Exodus is salvation. That is, God's people were saved from the bondage of Pharaoh. They were enslaved in Egypt. And God wonderfully, mercifully, miraculously set them free. So when you're thinking about the flow of the Bible, remember this. The book of Exodus deals with salvation, how God's people were saved from Pharaoh and from their bondage in Egypt. The book of Leviticus, though, deals with instruction, and inspiration. You see, Leviticus deals with now that they've been saved from Egypt, set free from the bondage, now Leviticus instructs them and inspires them about worship. And the whole book of Leviticus, as we have seen, deals with that issue. Approaching the Lord and honoring Him through the sacrifices that we bring. And that's the theme of Leviticus. Just like in your experience, we were saved from Egypt. And then we were inspired and instructed to worship in appreciation for what He did for us. So you have salvation, Exodus, instruction and inspiration, Leviticus, and now Numbers is the next step, and that is organization. And we have seen, we have talked through thus far, that God has a program, a plan for His people, and He is saying in the book of Numbers, you need to be organized. There needs to be accountability. There needs to be responsibility. There needs to be a submission to authority if there is going to be stability. God tells the people here in the book of Numbers, as He numbers them and puts them in order, what He is doing here, He's telling them where they are to pitch their tents, how they are to march on their journey, what they are to do as assignments are given to the various ones concerning the tabernacle and the functions. People have a tendency to say, hey, the Lord has saved me, Exodus, it's true, and I like to worship Him, I really do, Leviticus, but don't try to put some kind of a burden on me of responsibility, authority, and accountability. I'm born free, free as the wind blows. You know, that's my motto. I'm an independent guy, and I don't want to be brought into organization, authority, responsibility, and accountability. Just let me do my own thing. That is the very real tendency of people like you and me. In our fallen condition, we don't like to be organized. We don't want to be held in accountability. We want to do what we think. We want to march where we want to march and camp where we want to camp. And this idea of responsibility and this idea of submission to authority and this idea of linkage, hey, that rubs us the wrong way in our flesh, most definitely. But God knows something. He knows that that tendency of mine, of yours, to be independent, to do our own thing, can lead to disaster. We have to be linked together. The Bible says that we are rooted and grounded in truth. We're rooted and grounded in truth. Interesting. Because, you see, the Bible warns of strange winds of doctrine that will blow through a congregation or a community. And we've got to be rooted and grounded. How does that happen? One of the most practical ways that it happens is, well, just look at creation. Look at the strongest, tallest, largest, sturdiest plant in the plant kingdom. In fact, it's the largest thing, the largest living thing on the face of the globe, the sequoia redwood trees. You've seen them perhaps at Kings Canyon or Sequoia National Park. They're massive. They're gigantic. They're impressive. And they've stood the test of time for many, many, many centuries, actually millennia. They stand the test of time. They're sturdy. They're strong. But maybe you're not aware of this. It's interesting because those great big trees, they're so massive and so strong, and yet, because of their size, the root system of any given tree, any single tree, cannot provide stability for that tree. When winds blow, or when storms come and the soil gets wet, those sequoias will fall over. They'll fall to the ground. They'll topple down. Well, you say, didn't you say they were centuries old? Millennia old? Yes. Well, then how do they stand? One way and only one way. They grow in groves. The redwood trees grow in groves for a very important reason. Their roots are linked together. The roots of one tree are linked to the roots of the other. And consequently, as their roots are locked together, when the winds blow, and they do, when the storms come, and they will, the redwood tree is able to stand year after decade, after century, after millennium, for one reason only. They are rooted together. They're linked to each other. Now, what if Randy Redwood was to say, I just don't like being in this grove deal. I want to do my own thing. I want to transplant myself in my own little part of the park. I want to be where I want to be, and I want to do what I want to do. Okay, Randy, have your way. But I guarantee, as the years go on, Randy's going to have a great fall and splinter. He's not going to be what he could have been, what he should have been, what he would have been, had he been linked. Now, Peter tells us in his epistle that we are living stones being fit together. We are stones being fit together into a holy habitation, a holy house, if you would. Stones fit together. The problem is we are living stones, and consequently, unlike these stones behind me that are dead, living stones move. And because we move, we inevitably rub each other the wrong way. But you see, that's all part of the program. Being linked to people in accountability, in linkage, in commitment, with responsibility, what it does is, yeah, it rubs me the wrong way. And what it does, it knocks the rough edges off my block. You see, I'm a rough-edged person. Most of you are too. And we need to have those rough edges knocked off. And the only way that can happen is if a person says, through thick or thin, I'm committed to the things of the kingdom. I'm submitted to God's plan and program for me. I'm not going to be a lone ranger, an independent believer. And that's what the book of Numbers is emphasizing. We have to keep getting back to that fact, or you won't understand why this book is the way that it is. God is declaring in a very powerful way a story, and here's what he will say. There needs to be order, and there needs to be accountability. There needs to be commitment, and there needs to be responsibility if you are going to go into the promised land. If you want to be in the land of milk and honey, the Spirit-filled life, then there's no other way than to say, okay, Lord, I'm going your way. Your plan, your program, we're going to be linked to each other. We're going to move out as you tell us to. And that's God's desire for me. It's God's intention for you. So the book of Numbers is about organization. Now, we left off in chapter 5 with a very interesting passage. It's that ritual that takes place. Do you recall the story when a man suspects his wife of having an affair? He's to bring her to the temple. And the priest then is to scoop dust off the floor of the temple, pour it into an earthen jar that's full of holy water, write a curse on a parchment, and then dab with the water the words of the curse so the ink runs into the earthen pot, you see, absorbed there or going into the earthen pot where the holy water is, and then she's to drink that water if she is guilty of being unfaithful. Of being engaged in immorality, her belly will swell and her thighs will what? Rot. She'll have a swollen belly. Things aren't right internally. And her thighs will rot. That is, she's not going to walk like she did previously. That's what happens with sin. Things aren't right in your gut, in your soul. And your walk isn't what it used to be. It's not what it's supposed to be. Well, this happened to these gals literally. Their belly swelled, their thighs rotted. Now, it's interesting because in chapter 6 that we just read through, it deals with this wonderful, wonderful chapter of a person, a man or a woman who says, I desire to be consecrated and dedicated to the Lord. I'm going then to take a Nazarite vow. Nazer in the Hebrew simply means to separate. I'm going to separate myself for this period of time to be totally consecrated to the Lord, focused on the Lord. I'm going to put aside everything else to be focused on the Lord. to seek after him. Now, the rabbis tell us traditionally that the average length of time for a Nazirite vow generally was a month. Sometimes it would go for a year or 10. And on three occasions in the Bible, it would seem the Nazirite vow was a lifetime calling for three. The first, you know his name well, Samson. Remember, he was to be a Nazirite from his birth until the day of his death. He was never to cut his hair. John the Baptist could very well have been a Nazirite as well. And also the prophet Samuel. We do know that Samson was, Jabez and Samuel the prophet, they could have been Nazirites as well. But generally, it was for a length of time when a man would say, hey, I want to spend time with the Lord and focusing on the Lord. He or she would take a Nazirite vow, consecration, but wait. Before there can be consecration, there has to be purification. And that's why chapter 5 comes before chapter 6. Good reason. Chapter 5 comes before chapter 6 because God is dealing with the issue of purity, moral purity, before he talks about the Nazirite possibility. There has to be the dealing with this issue of morality before there can be this dealing with the issue of ministry. Chapter 5 deals with morality. Chapter 6 deals with ministry. Chapter 5 is conviction. Chapter 6 is consecration. Chapter 5 is suspicion. Chapter 6 is dedication. Now, you say, well, if that's the case, if this Nazirite thing that chapter 6 is talking about, where a guy is dedicated to focusing on the Lord, giving himself to the Lord, if there has to be this issue of morality, I guess I might as well just sort of check out and schnooze during the rest of this study. Because I failed, you may say. I have fallen into problems, sin. I've dropped the ball morally. I've been impure, whatever it might be. Keep in mind that chapter 5, this weird deal where the woman had to drink the water. Hey, it all brings us to chapter 8 of John's Gospel. Remember the story? What happened in John 8? A woman was caught in the act of adultery. She was brought nakedly before Jesus. God in the flesh, Jesus Christ. God in an earthen vessel. The Bible talks about the body as being an earthen vessel. In the incarnation, God took on humanity. So here's Jesus, the earthen vessel. What's he doing in John 8? He was giving out the holy water, which is the Word. Now you are clean to the Word which I've spoken to you. We are washed by the water of the Word, Ephesians 5 says to me and you. So here's Jesus. Now keep this in mind. The earthen vessel, full of the holy water, she was being accused. What did he do? He wrote on the temple floor in the dust. Remember the dust in our chapter before us, chapter 5? The dust was scooped up. Jesus used the dust. He is the earthen vessel, full of the holy water. What about the curse? The curse that was written on the paper and would flow down into the holy water. Jesus, he who knew no sin, the Bible says, was what? Made sin. He absorbed my curse. He absorbed your curse. Hey, if you have erred, and we all have sinned, you need to understand that Jesus is the earthen vessel who gives out the holy water, absorbing the curse, writing in the dust. All the elements of chapter 5, the end that we looked at last time, are fulfilled in Jesus Christ. He absorbed the curse for me. He has given me a fresh start. He's given that to you too. To anybody who will say, Lord, I need a fresh start. I need you. Hey, there is therefore now no condemnation. Woman, he said to her, woman, where are thine accusers? And she said, no man accuses me. They all went their way. Jesus said, neither do I accuse you. Go your way and sin no more. I'm setting you free. And believe you me, that woman, I am confident, went her way and lived in a whole different style from that very day. She was set free. That's what the Lord does for you and for me over and over again. His grace is sufficient. So, chapter 6, the Nazarite. Now, in the organization of God's people, God says, here's the deal. It's not just the priests who have the privilege of seeking me or the Levites who have the honor of serving me. Any man or any woman from any tribe has this opportunity. If they choose to, he or she from any tribe can become a Nazarite. That is set aside or set apart to seek me, to worship me, to focus on me, to serve me. Anybody. But here's the stipulation. There's three things that God says I'm desiring or demanding, and that is, first of all, he says in this text, this Nazarite who wants to seek me and serve me, focus on me and live for me. This Nazarite, this one that separates themselves, man or woman, verse 2 says, of any of the children of Israel, first of all, there is to be a determination. If you're taking notes, jot that word down. Number one, determination. There is to be a determination to allow nothing to intoxicate you. There's to be no strong drink, no wine. In fact, don't even head for the vinegar. In fact, don't even eat grapes. In fact, don't even eat raisins. Now, why is that? The Lord knows that those that really desire to focus on Him and be used by Him must not allow their mind to be fuzzy. Don't become intoxicated. Well, grapes won't intoxicate or raisins won't. Well, God knows our tendency. We'll fudge. We'll figure out a way to get intoxicated grapes, you see. We'll figure out a way to get fermented raisins or whatever it might be. It's like when somebody says, you know, a number of years ago, there was a guy here, great guy, but he was on this 40-day fast. And it was interesting because we would talk, and as the 40 days went on, true story, he got fatter and fatter. And I thought, this is strange. So, I mean, he was gaining weight, and he was just totally fasting on only, you know, liquid. And I said, well, what are you doing? Well, he had this blender, and he put in this blender. He put yogurt and ice cream and eggs and bananas and protein and instant breakfast and, you know, and then, yep, I'm on a fast for the Lord. And he would drink this meal, you know, and he thought that he was on this fast, but he missed the point. I mean, so people do that. We have that tendency to say, well, yes, I'm going to be on a fast. And so we, you know, live on milkshakes and we say we're not eating food or whatever it might be. That's our tendency. The Lord knows that. He knows that I'll tend to fudge. And so he says, look, if you're going to be a Nazarite, you've got to be clear-headed and focused. Therefore, no grapes, no raisins, lest you find a way to get a buzz from them. There must be nothing that would cause you to be intoxicated. Now, listen, I'll read to you. Don't turn there, but just listen. Might want to mark it down. The Nazarites, God says, I raised up in Amos chapter 2, verse 11, I raised up of your sons for prophets and your young men to be Nazarites. But you gave the Nazarites wine to drink. Amos here is on the scene who says the Nazarites were to be in a place of totally abstaining from that which would fuzzy their thinking. But you, he says to the people of his day, blurred those lines and you gave them wine to drink. Later on, Isaiah declares this when he says concerning the ministry that men were called to. But they have erred, speaking of his servants, through wine and through strong drink they are gone out of the way. They err in vision, they stumble in judgment, for they are swallowed up of wine. God declares that those that want to be used by him and really hear from him need to have a clear head and stay away from anything. Wine, strong drink, drugs, or whatever it might be that would cause intoxication. Listen to what Proverbs 31 says. What, my son? Give not thy strength unto women, which destroys kings, nor give yourself to drink wine. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, nor princes to drink strong drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the judgment of the afflicted. Give strong drink to those that are ready to perish, and wine to those that be of heavy heart. Not legalism. God is declaring in His Word, if you want to be used and focused to the greatest degree, then keep your mind clear and stay away from wine and strong drink. It's not for kings. It's not for princes. Now, that's not applying to everybody. But if you want to be a leader in ministry, a leader in your home, a leader at work, if you want to be really totally on the cutting edge of being used by God, if you want to be a Nazarite, then the word applies to you, to me. Stay away from that which would cause you to forget the law and pervert the judgment, Proverbs 31 says. I have a hard enough time remembering the word as I am. I don't need to have stuff to fuzzy my already fuzzy mind. I need to be focused. If you came to my house in Jacksonville and you were going through some kind of a crisis and you knocked on my door on Huner Lane and I opened the door and I was holding a martini, would you say, oh good, I'm glad John's, you know, having a few martinis here tonight because now he can give me real good counsel. Now he can really help me sort this through and search the scriptures. Or would you say, what are you doing? I thought you were supposed to be focused on service and the Word. And why do you have that martini or that can of Bud in your hand? What's the deal? It just is incongruous. It doesn't make sense. It's inconsistent for those that would say, I truly desire to be used. You stay away from alcohol. Very simple. Point blank. Now, that's not applying to people that say, I don't want to be used. Then that's okay. But if you're saying, I want to be a king or a prince, a Nazarite, a priest, a leader, then these words I think you need to be aware of. Stay away from anything that is intoxicating. So there's a determination. I'm going to stay far away from grapes or raisins, anything that can touch on intoxication. So are you saying you shouldn't have sun-kissed raisins? I'm not saying that. You're missing the point there. I'm saying you don't fudge. You don't say, well, this is okay because it's got a lower alcoholic content. Or it's O'Doul's or whatever it might be. You just stay away from all that whole scene, you see. So the second thing the Nazarite is to do, after determination, there is to be identification. Verse 5. When you're in this state of saying, I'm availing myself to you, I want to be focused on you, then identify yourself by letting your hair grow long. In those days, hey, Fabio wasn't around. If a guy had long hair, it was not considered to be cool or, hey man, Fabio or Hollywood or what have you. If a guy had long hair, it was a real odd thing. It was a mark that would set you apart from all other society. The Jewish people cropped their hair, the men did. So if a guy had long hair running down his back, it would be a sign, hey, this guy is a Nazarite. It was completely contrary to what they did. Consequently, a man with long hair would be marked. In other words, you could see him from a mile away. Hey, here's a Nazarite. He was identifying himself. That too must happen. I was talking to a guy a couple of days ago, kidding with him. And I said, you know, you need to put a K-Apple sticker on your car. And he said, well, you know, I speed a lot and I don't always stop at the stop signs. So, you know, I don't want to put a K-Apple sticker on my car because of that. I don't want to identify in that way. And I said, you know what? Maybe you should put a K-Apple sticker on your car and not break the speed limit and stop at the stop signs. Maybe the key isn't to say, I'm not going to identify myself, but maybe the key is to identify yourself and be aware that that sticker is there. I tell people it's important, if you really want to be used, to be on record wherever you go, to be identifiable. How? Carry your Bible with you, perhaps, or slap a sticker on your car, or wear a Living Epistles t-shirt or something, but let people know from the very get-go where you stand. It'll save you a lot of headaches and heartaches because people will see you from a mile away and they'll say, hey, you're one of those Christians, eh? Yeah, that's good for you to be on record. It'll keep you out of trouble, you see. It'll help you to watch the speed limit and stop at the stop signs because you're a marked man, you see. So a Nazirite is to be, first of all, determined. That is determination. I'm not going to allow anything to intoxicate my mind. Secondly, there is an identification. I'm going on record that I'm different than others. I'm not trying to be incognito, secret Christian, nobody knows what I am or where I am. But rather, I'm going on record. I want everybody to know where I stand. And number three, there was to be separation. The third thing that I want you to mark here, note here, as a Nazirite, there was to be separation. It says, verse 6, all the days that he separates himself, he shall come at no dead body. Not even for the sake of father, mother, brother, or sister when they die. You are to be separated from corpses. Well, you say, I'm not really into funeral parlors anyway. We're not talking about corpses literally here. What we're talking about is, you know that there are places in town, places all around, places on the TV set where there's nothing but dead bodies. That is, it's nothing but death. It's nothing but death. You are to stay away from such places. If you, if I, if we desire to be a Nazirite, really focused on the Lord and being used by Him. What do you mean, stay away? Shouldn't we witness? Well, that's a whole other matter. Jesus showed us about that, didn't He? He was the friend of sinners. But the point is, He befriended them for one reason. They were immediately drawn to Him and confronted by Him and changed. The idea here is this. If I'm just enjoying hanging around places where dead people are, there's a problem. If I'm going for the purpose of ministry, that's a whole nother situation. But too often, people are hanging around where corpses are, on the screens, or in town, or whatever it might be. Nazirites can't do that. They've got to stay away from dead bodies. Yeah, but my brother's going there, or my mother's into that, or my dad is saying let's go, even for father, mother, sister, or brother, it says in our text. Do you recall what Jesus said? It's pretty radical. Jesus said, unless you hate father, mother, sister, or brother, you cannot follow me. That shakes a lot of people up. You mean I'm supposed to hate my dad or hate my mom? No, what Jesus is saying, and they understood it in that day very clearly, is that your love for God should be so passionate and so real and vibrant and virile that your love for any other person is hatred in comparison. So if mom and dad or sister or brother or friend or colleague or boss or neighbor say, come on, let's go where the corpses are today, you'll say, sorry. Well, don't you love me? You know, I do, but I love the Lord a whole lot more. He's the Lord of my life, and I'm going to honor Him. By His grace and with His help until the day I die, I'm going to honor Him, and I'm going to stay away from the corpses because the Nazirite will defile himself in that way. Now, something I want you to think through with me tonight on this, and that is this. The Nazirite, Numbers chapter 6. I hope you're listening, and I hope you're perhaps thinking this through or jotting some stuff down, because this teaching needs to be shared with your kids, with your friends, with your grandchildren, with people that you're connected to who are single. You see, the Nazirite speaks specifically of a single-minded devotion, a single-hearted passion, where a man, where a woman says, I'm separating myself and focusing on the Lord. It's a real important paradigm, picture, illustration, teaching for single people. You see, marriage is important. Do you know that? Because marriage pictures, Ephesians chapter 5 says, it's a picture of Jesus' love for the church, corporately, and the church's love for Jesus. Ephesians 5, if you haven't read it, you need to study it through. It talks about husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave Himself. In other words, hubby, Give it up, lay your life down for the sake of your wife. Wives, submit yourselves unto your husbands, even as the church is submitted to Jesus, who laid down his life for us. Paul said, marriage is a mystery. And he says in Ephesians 5, this is the mystery. It was not previously understood until now. It's a picture. It's an illustration. That people in your neighborhood, the people on the job might say, I understand something of this Jesus thing because I see the way you treat your wife. Or I see the way you submit and honor your husband. Man, it's to be a living illustration, a living sermon. Now, that's true. But so too, a person who is single. Not bemoaning their single state, not saying, man, I hate where I'm at and I wish I was married. But rather who will say, for this season, I am a Nazarite. I'm a Nazarite. For this season in my life, I am singly devoted and singly focused on the Lord. I am going to live my life in this way. Now, Paul has this to say. Listen to this. This is amazing to me. Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, just listen. He says, I would that all men were even as myself. He's talking about in his single state. Paul was not married. Probably he had been married at some point, for he was a member of the Jewish Sanhedrin, or the Jewish Supreme Court. And one of the qualifications to be a member of the Sanhedrin was you needed to be married. And so probably he was married. Well, why isn't he now? When he writes this, one may say. Perhaps his wife died. More than likely, she left him. Jewish tradition, custom, would demand that a woman leave her husband if he converted, if you would, if he left Judaism. And probably that's what happened. We can't be certain. But something happened where Paul now is single and he says, look, I would that all men were even as myself. Every man has his proper gift of God, one after this manner, another after that. So I say to the unmarried, it is good for them if they abide even as I, Paul says. But if they cannot contain, let them marry. It is better to marry than to burn. The idea there is, if you can handle it, if you have the gift for it, be single. If you can't, if you're burning with desire, with passion, that's okay. Better to marry than to burn. But if you can navigate it by being single, that's superior. He says this, are you bound to a wife? Don't seek to be loosed. Are you loosed from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But and if you marry, verse 28 says, you have not sinned. If a virgin marries, she has not sinned. And then he says this, check this out, 1 Corinthians 7:28. Nevertheless, such shall have trouble in the flesh. Who? Those that choose to get married. Such shall have trouble in the flesh, and I would spare you. Interesting. Paul says, it's okay to marry, but you're going to have troubles, and I would spare you. See, he is saying, if you can handle it and navigate it, there are advantages to being single. What are you suggesting, John? How many of you are single here tonight? Raise your hand. See? Yeah, everybody's checking it out. Ooh, yeah. See? The Word of God says that is not to be a state that is bemoaned or poor me or woe, I'm single, but rather it's to be elevated and celebrated. That Paul says you are in a better place being single, if you can navigate that, than if you're married. The Bible is amazing. Because all of our culture wants to get married or linked up, but the Bible says if you can handle this, if you're able to, it's a better place to be. Now, marriage is fine, Paul says, but really, if you can, it's a great place to be for this Nazarite season that you're in. Interesting. Paul came to that conclusion, like the story of the guy that goes down to the pond, the old farmer, and he's walking around the pond and this frog looks up at him and says, kiss me quick, I'll turn into a beautiful princess. And he kind of winks and blinks and picks this frog up and holds this frog in his hand. Kiss me quick, I'll turn into a beautiful princess. And he puts this frog in the pockets of his overalls and walks around for about an hour or so and reaches in and takes the frog out once more. And the frog says, kiss me quick, I'll turn into a beautiful princess. Stuffs her back in the pocket. walks around for a few more hours doing his chores and pulls her out. Kiss me quick, I'll turn into a beautiful princess. Well, this happens for the rest of the day. That night, he's getting ready for bed. He pulls the frog out once more, and she says, kiss me quick, I'll turn into a beautiful princess. And he says, no. Why won't you kiss me? I'll turn into a beautiful princess. And he says, because frankly, at this point in my life, I'd rather have a talking frog. That's what Paul is saying, basically. He's saying, look, frankly, he says, at this point in life, let me tell you something. At this point in life, listen, if you can be like I am, you're going to be in a better place, focused on the things of the kingdom. So, what you need to see and tell your kids and help others to understand too is, hey, don't bewail your singleness. It's a superior state according to what Paul the apostle had to say. But take note, there needs to be three things if you're going to navigate this single life successfully. There needs to be, number one, determination. Don't let yourself become influenced by the intoxicants of the world. Stay away from the places where there's drinking and drugs and wine sipping and brie and all those things that go on. Don't go there because you're single, and in your single state, you will be vulnerable to sin. There isn't a month that goes by where we don't deal with that issue here at Applegate, where somebody who is single got in trouble, sexually oftentimes, because of alcohol. Because they were popping a bud, or they were at some restaurant and drinking whatever. Don't do that. Stay away from anything that would cause your mind to be fuzzy, a vulnerability that would lead to a sad and heartbreaking problem. If you're gonna be single, hey, there's got to be a determination. I am not going to allow intoxicants to fuzzy my thinking, to lower my barriers. I'm gonna stay away. Number two, there needs to be identification. What do you mean? Just like we talked about, you need to go on record. Don't be Mr. Cool or Miss whatever, incognito, not letting anybody know, because that guy is going to come your way and ask you out. And you're going to look at him and you're going to say, man, he's handsome. Or, hey, he would be fun, or he's a nice guy. He's not a Christian, but you know, he's asking me out, and so, hey, I'll just go and see if I can maybe witness to him, you see. 2 Corinthians 6:14 says, do not be unequally yoked together. If you start on that path of missionary dating, chances are you are going to end up heartbroken, and you're going to end up in a sad, sad, sad condition. Don't go there. What do you mean then? What should I do? Let people know that you're a Christian. Wear a great big fish around your neck. You know, like a salmon or a trout. That'll keep them away. But, you know, go on record. Listen, so that when he comes up to you girls, or when you see her guys, whatever the case might be, you're already identified, you see. You're not going to have to inform him or her later on that you go to church sometimes. It's going to be out there. Keep a Bible on your desk, a sticker on your car. Keep something before all the time, the people that will be perhaps coming your way, that they will identify you as one of those radical, Jesus-loving, Spirit-filled Christians that goes to Applegate. That'll scare them away. That will keep people at bay. It'll save you a whole lot of pain. Don't try to be cool. Go on record. It'll save you a whole bunch of headaches and heartbreaks. The Nazarites, they were told specifically, hey, identify yourself from a mile away so that people can see a mile away that you are one that's consecrated, dedicated, focused on God, you see. Number three, they were to be involved, or pardon me, not to be involved with dead bodies. Enough said, I think. Well, I'll say some more, actually. Separation from dead bodies. You got to stay away from dead bodies. You've got to. Listen, don't go hanging around where the corpses are dancing. You don't go there. You stay away. You know, don't, you know, get your sunglasses out and your gold chain shined up and, hey, baby, you know, you put that stuff away. Get rid of your gold chain. Don't do that. You know what you need to do? You need to say, I'm not going to go where the corpses are carousing. Period. Period. I'm just not going to do that. Rip out your cable TV if you need to, whatever it takes. But you say, I am a Nazarite. I am going to be determined not to get involved in the intoxicants of the world. I'm going to be identified by everybody as a radical believer, and I'm going to separate myself completely and totally, even from my mother, my father, my sister, my brother, who wants to go carousing with corpses. I won't do it. I just plain old flat out won't. Now, you say, well, what if I have done those things, John? What if I have been carousing with corpses? Or I have been trying to be Mr. Sneaky Single Christian, you know, and not let people know? But what if I've been involved in those things? What then? What if I have been taking in intoxicants and not been identifying myself? What if I've blown it? Well, quickly look with me at this chapter 6 passage here, because in verses 9, 10, and 11, what does it say? It says concerning contamination. If, verse 9, a man die very suddenly by him, the Nazarite, if there's a dead body there and it happens, what are you to do? You are to shave your head, verse 9 says. You're to bring your offering, and you shall then bring, verse 12, the consecration offering of the lamb of the first year for a trespass offering. The lamb is brought into the equation. The lamb speaks of who? Jesus Christ. That's cool. If you've blown it, and we all have, understand this. The lamb, the blood of the lamb, cleanses. But I want you to see this next phrase. I want you to note it. I want you to share it and be aware of it. But the days that were before shall be lost because his separation is defiled. In other words, if a guy says, I'm going to be a Nazarite for 60 days, and on day 59, a dead body is right there next to him or next to her, well, then he or she is to shave the head, he or she is to bring the lamb, and he or she is to start again. You see, they already had 59 days logged in, but now since they were contaminated by this corpse, now they go back to day one. Now that sounds like a bummer maybe, but it's not. It means to you and me, hey, yes, you go back, but you go back and get a fresh start on that day. You get to. It's not a got to. Oh, I got to still be dedicated to you for 59 more days now. It's not a got to. It's a get to. God says, you get to go back to square one. And I'm going to start with you again. I'm not kicking you out. I'm not turning you away. But you go back to square one. And we're going to start again. And we're going to do it again the right way. Do you understand this? So they go back to where they started, and once again, they start the program all over, you see. Well, there's one more thing, and then we'll be done, and that's this. People say, well, it's not so much, John, in my state as being a single, it's not so much an issue of failure, a dead body or whatever. It's not a matter of a failure, it's a matter, quite frankly, of fatigue. I'm tired of being a Nazarite. I'm tired, John. I love the Lord, but I'm tired of being single. Watch this, because this verse 13, after verses 9, 10, and 11 deal with contamination, verses 13 through 21 deal with completion. Watch this. This is the law, verse 13 of the Nazarites. When the days of his separation are what? Fulfilled. There is a season for a Nazarite. And when that season comes to completion, then he brings the offerings prescribed. He goes through the ritual that we've read through, and he is now completed in the promise or the vow that he had taken. Hey, it's for a season. So what are you suggesting? Just this. In this Nazarite season that a single person is in, if God put a desire in a person's heart to be married, to be a bride, to be linked in intimacy, to share their life with somebody, God did not put that in your heart to frustrate you. He put it in your heart to fulfill it. Paul said, look, hey, I'm happy to be single. If you can, I hope you can too. But if not, hey, get married. Because God puts desires in our hearts that conform, that match up to His will for our lives. Do you understand that? He puts desires in our hearts that conform to His will for our lives. So what are you saying? I'm saying, here's what you've got to do. Here's what you get to do. Here's what you got to tell your kids to do and others around you. God knows your need, the desire of your heart when you're in that single place wanting to be married. God saw Adam's need in the Garden of Eden before Adam even knew that he had a need. Do you know that? God said, it is not good for him to dwell alone. Adam didn't even know that he was lonely. God said, I see his need. He doesn't even know it. Now I'm going to make him aware of it. Adam, God said, go name the animals. Okay. And as he named them, we read in the Genesis account, he named them male and what? Female. Mr. and Mrs. Hippo, Mr. and Mrs. Giraffe, Mr. and Mrs. Rhino, Mr. and Mrs. Orangutan. And somewhere along the line, when he was doing that, it hit him. Wait a minute. There's male and female of every animal, of every creature. But me, there's no counterpart. See, God made him aware of his need. He didn't even know he had one. God's done the same with you. You go, hey, Valentine's Day, home again. What's the deal? I'm lonely. Why is this way? Well, who made you aware of that need? I talked with a guy today in one of the meetings I had who was simply saying, you know, in my single state, he said, I really am enjoying it. I don't really want to be married again. That's great. But maybe you're not in that place. Maybe you say, well, that might be fine for your friend or for Paul the Apostle, but for me, no. Well, God put that in your heart, not to frustrate you, but to fulfill it. You say, when? When? That's part three of Adam's story. God said, this man has a need. Number two, I'm going to make him aware of his need. Name the animals, Adam. And then he said to him that day, now, Adam, go to sleep. He didn't say go on the singles cruise. He didn't say attend the singles seminar. What did he say? He said, go to sleep. And when Adam was asleep at rest, God took a rib from his side and fashioned a woman for him. And he woke up and saw her and said, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. Which, as we've talked about before, it's that Hebrew idiom. Body, soul, and spirit, you're my corresponding counterpart. Physically, I'm attracted to you. Soulically, we're on the same wavelength. And spiritually, hey, there's a unity and a commonness. That's the way it will always be when you find the right mate. Body, soul, and spirit, all three have got to be in place. A physical attraction, you think on the same wavelength. And spiritually, you have the same commitment to the cause of the kingdom. You're not leading him, gals, or you're not dragging her, guys. There's a commonness of spirit. There's a oneness of soul. And there's an attraction physically. And that's what he meant when he said, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. You are my exact counterpart, my fulfillment. Whoa, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. This is it. Eureka. Wonderful. Awesome. Now, what would have happened if Adam said, I just can't sleep. I'm just so anxious about finding Miss Wright. I'm gonna climb the trees. I'm gonna swing from vines. Oh yeah, yeah. I'm gonna wear my loincloth, you know. I'm gonna really go out and find that woman, you know. What would happen if Adam didn't go to sleep? I'll tell you what would have happened. He would have found somebody to be his counterpart. It would have probably been an ape, a gorilla, or an orangutan. Because that would have been the closest. Well, you're a little hairy, but you know, you're basically the same structure that I am. I mean, you know, Miss Gorilla or Miss Orangutan, you know, interesting coloring, but you know, I guess this is I've been looking all over the place. I've been climbing trees, beating bushes, checking out, and I guess baboon, you'll do. And that's what would have happened to Adam. He would have ended up with a baboon, an orangutan, a gorilla, an ape, or a monkey. And that's what happens to a lot of Christian singles. They end up with baboons, gorillas, apes, and monkeys. Because they're just determined to find him or find her. And we're going to go here and try this and be a part of that group. And there's a cruise leaving Catalina Island. And we're going to... And don't do that. You'll end up with a ape. What should you do? You go to sleep. And you say, Lord, you know my need. And you know my address. And you know my phone number. And you know everything about me. And at the right time, whenever that might be, 6 months from now, 6 years from now, 60 years from now, or when the ultimate bridegroom comes, Jesus Christ, and says, come up here, my beloved. You're my bride. And I've kept you for myself. And you've been pure. And now enter into the joy. Hey, you're not going to say, well, I got a bone to pick with you, Lord. It's about this single deal. What you're going to say in that day is you're going to say, Lord, thank you for keeping me in the place you had me, because this moment, Lord, of being with you and all of eternity that follows, oh Lord, it's so worth it. I don't know when he's going to meet that, but I do know this. It's not going to happen in the way it's supposed to until you go to sleep. Lay it to rest. Let it go. And simply say, Lord, you know best. That's the key. In our text, it says, when the days of his separation are complete. There is a day when those days are complete. And God will see you through if you just trust in him like I know you do. That's the key. The Nazarite vow. Lots of things to think about. You say, John, I'm pretty much versed in these things. Great. Are your kids? Are your friends? Share number 6. Don't just give your ideas about how to navigate the single life. Open up the Bible and say, let me share with you what we just went through in number 6. You get to be a Nazarite. Hey, celebrate. Stay away from intoxications, man. Go on record with a radical identification. Let people know where you stand. And make sure that there's complete separation from all dead bodies, because they'll destroy you. See, that's the key. I am concerned, as we all are, in these days in which we live, with this issue of dead bodies, pornography. Singles, listen to me. If you indulge in that, and it's so available today because of the technology of the internet and all the rest, you're setting yourself up for a real, real problem. Because the problem is the images that you look at and the scenes that you take in and the stuff you watch or read or whatever it might be, you'll take with you into marriage when that day comes. And this is the damnable part of pornography. It is unreal, obviously, But what happens in the heart of a woman or in the mind of a man is that that person that you saw on the screen or in the magazine somehow intrigues you, and your new spouse doesn't live up to that imagery, which is a lie, by the way. And so you look at her and you're discontent. Here's this bride or this hubby that God sent your way, but you have all this stuff in your mind and your soul. And your bride or your hubby doesn't live up to that which you saw in the video or whatever it might be. And so you think, well, I must not have the right spouse. And so you begin to look around and wonder, I wonder if somebody out there is closer to this imagery that I have in my mind. And that leads, of course, to disaster. It's unattainable. It is an absolute disaster, and that's why God says, not prudishly, but with wisdom, don't set any unclean thing before your eyes. You will have greater sexual ecstasy and happiness if you stay away absolutely, totally, completely from dead bodies, particularly pornography. You stay away. I don't care if it's won 8 Oscars. I don't care if everybody in the whole church went to see Titanic. If there is anything in a film, a movie, a show, whatever, where there is nudity, you say, I'm not going to go, period. If there is that kind of display, oh, in the name of artistry, people would say, I'm embarrassed, quite frankly, by how many spiritual leaders and pastors talk about Titanic. It's a real sad, sad state. It's a failure to understand. That'd be like me saying, well, you know, kids, I realize this is a great meal that Mom has fixed. Now, in one piece of the vegetables, there is arsenic, but we'll overall, it's a good meal. One piece has cyanide, but overall it's a really good meal. If I knew that one piece on that plate that sat before Ben or Mary had arsenic or cyanide, I would grab that whole plate and I would say, you're not going to touch that plate. Oh, but it's all so good, just one little part. No, the whole thing is doomed. It will cause death because of that one little part. And it's time for Christians like you and me to say, hey, we're not going to poison ourselves that will then take away sexual happiness and fulfillment in marriage. We're not going to set ourselves up for that stuff. If there's those kinds of things in it, we're not going to watch it. Period. I don't care what everybody else does. I don't care how many awards it wins. I don't care what the critics say. If you really want your marriage to be what it's supposed to be, whether you're single now or married presently, you say, not going to do that because it will cause problems in my marriage. It will cause problems in our intimacy. And I want the best for my wife, myself, my family. Don't you want the best for yours too? Stay away from dead bodies. Well, let's stand, shall we? We stand, Father, in your presence, exploring the scriptures and wanting to be separated from the stuff that would destroy and defile. Father, where we have failed, I'm so thankful that we get to start again. I'm so thankful, Lord, that we get to shave our heads once more and bring the Lamb into the equation, that you don't turn us away, but you take us back. And I thank you for that fact. And I pray, Lord, that we would understand these principles and not only apply them to our lives, but help me, help us to share them with family members, with other sisters and brothers. Father, I pray that we might see a group of people in the fellowship family that are really consecrated to you, excited about you, dedicated to the things of you, Lord. So help us now, Lord. We've heard your heart and we've seen the example, the picture. And I pray that it would not be lost as we get in our cars and drive away, but that we might find these things, Lord, to be built into our thinking patterns, sown into our souls, and lived out. Lord, your ways are right. We confess that. We embrace it. And now we seek your empowering that we might live it out in a way that would be glorifying to you. And this we do pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Amen.